Call the meeting to order.
Welcome, everybody. It's great to see you all. Everybody looks a little more refreshed than when we left here last time. Been out in the sun a bit. So thank you for coming, some of you from a distance. And we have really two items on our agenda today that we want to do. And this is to follow up on some of the really good work that this committee and the legislature did in the last legislative session. We looked at the issue of racial disparities in homeownership, and we looked at a number of other issues. We did some good bonding funding that I hope is reaching into all of our districts, some of the work that has to be done in that. So I thank everybody for coming today. We're going to have a presentation on the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency's 2015 Affordable Housing Plan. And it'll be a chance for us to talk with the commissioner about our ideas and concerns and feedback on the plan that they have developed. And then also a presentation from the Metropolitan Council on their housing plan. So this is really a chance for some legislative oversight and input. These plans are in the process of being accepted and adopted. So we have some of the community members who've been involved in this work for a while who will be speaking with us. And then, of course, if there is anyone else who wants to address the committee, we can take a little time for that, too. So welcome, and thank you, staff, for being here. We have a new staff today, not new to the legislature, but Jenny's filling in, and we're really happy that she's being here with us. So we'll go ahead and get started, and the first person on the agenda is Commissioner Tangersall. I think I saw, there she is, yes, and Katie Topinka. Well, Commissioner, I was just noticing that you seem further away. We're in a bigger room, so that's why. Anyway, welcome, and thank you for putting this on your schedule and coming to share the plan with us.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Mary Tangersall, and I am Commissioner at Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. And just to give a little bit of background on our affordable housing plan, this is a process that Minnesota Housing goes through every year. We have decided historically that it makes the most sense for us to design our programmatic budget. That's all the dollars that will go out into the community with a October 1 start date and a September 30th end date. And the reason for that is that we administer a wide variety of funds that include state dollars and federal dollars. And as you well know, the federal fiscal year starts on October 1st, and we just found over the years that that is the easiest program year for us to manage. It also means that because our state legislature ends in May of each year, that when we go into our planning process for the next affordable housing plan, it is at a time when we know what the decisions of the state legislature have been, and therefore we're able to take into account any appropriations or bonding authority that is approved by the legislature. So we generally gear up our planning process in May of each year, where we begin to seek various input from members of the public in a kind of an informal way. We then, after the state legislature has completed its meetings, we really ramp up in June of each year to really intensely take a look at the resources that we think we'll have from all the various sources, and then put a draft plan out to the public in early August. We posted this plan that you'll be hearing about today on August 13th. And it is open for public comments until this coming Friday, the 29th. We will be presenting it publicly to our board of directors on Thursday of this week, August 28th. Then next week, we will take a look at the comments that we've received, and we will develop any changes to the plan that we think are warranted based on the comments that we've received. We'll then present those to our board of directors, and then we'll ask the board of directors to adopt that plan on the fourth Thursday in September, and then the new plan will go into effect October 1st. And so it really is, it's not an officially mandated document. It is just something that our board of directors for many years has decided is a good way to communicate to the public how we intend to deploy the various resources that are at our disposal over the coming year. We then use that to develop our department plans within the agency, and so we take the level of detail that's in the Affordable Housing Plan, and we then parcel that out to our multifamily, single family, and homelessness areas and set up actual goals of number of units, et cetera, that will help us to actually accomplish this plan. So we use it very much like you would a business plan within a business. It really is set out to determine how many households will serve with what kinds of assistance. So that's really what this document is. Again, it's not an officially mandated plan. It is something that we have found to be just a good business practice over the years for communicating to the public how the resources of Minnesota Housing will be set forth. So with that, I'd like to go to the first page of the presentation, which just gives you the starting point, and that is our mission, and that is that Minnesota Housing finances affordable housing for low and moderate income households while fostering strong communities. And that last phrase is really important. We think it's important for the Housing Finance Agency to not just put money out into the community on a random basis. Rather, we work very closely with communities around the state to help them plan for what are the particular needs in their community, and then be able to work with them for how those resources are then deployed in their communities. And that might mean working closely with a neighborhood in the city of Minneapolis. We do have on our staff a woman by the name of Margaret Kaplan, who is our community development director, who, you know, throughout the year works with communities to help them put together competitive applications for those funds that we have that are competitive, and to really try to get our resources out in ways that really have a positive impact in the different communities around the state. In some cases, that means working on workforce housing with local employers. In other cases, it might be working on foreclosure mitigation in an area like the east side of St. Paul. So there's a lot of different variety for what communities need. And thankfully, we have a lot of tools that communities can utilize to work with those. So what is the current environment in which we find ourselves trying to meet the needs of affordable housing? Right now, having started to come out of the recession, actually the need for affordable housing is unfortunately growing. And why is that? What we're seeing is that as the economy is recovering, for example, vacancy rates in rental properties are falling, and what that means is that landlords are raising their rents at a time when we know that incomes of low and moderate income households have stayed pretty flat. And so what we have is a growing gap between rents and the amount that people have to spend on housing. As a result, about 600,000 households in Minnesota are what we call cost burdened. What that means is that those households are paying more than 30% of their incomes for their housing, whether that's homeowners or renters. For renters, it's a much larger proportion. Almost 50% of renters actually pay more than 30% of their income for their housing costs. About 10,000 Minnesotans on any given day when they do a count are currently homeless, and more than half of those are children and youth. So homelessness, unfortunately, is still with us. We did adopt last year as a state a statewide plan to prevent and end homelessness. And you'll be seeing over the next several months some of the ideas coming forward from the Interagency Council on Homelessness about how we're tackling that problem, not just with housing, but with many of the other safety net programs that we have available. There's also a growing need for what we call preservation. And what does preservation mean? What that means is there are about 40,000 units of housing in Minnesota that were built 35 to 40 years ago with sort of older federal programs that attached rental subsidies to the actual building. And many of you may be familiar with those in your communities, where it may be the senior citizen high-rise in town that has very affordable rents. And those are generally under two different programs. One is the federal Section 8 program, which is administered by the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And the other is USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture 515 program. That used to be called the Farm Home Administration. And they have about 6,000 units that have subsidies attached to the buildings. And so between that, we have this very valuable resource of properties, of about 40,000 properties that have very low and very affordable rents, which often house people with disabilities, elderly, and families in both our urban and rural communities. Now, that's a good thing. The bad thing is most of that housing was actually constructed between 35 and 40 years ago. And so, like most things, particularly in a harsh climate like Minnesota, they need improvements over time. And oftentimes the rents that are charged for these properties aren't enough to build up a big capital reserve to be able to do those big ticket items. And so this legislature has been very helpful in allocating bonding dollars and appropriated dollars to help us to work with those owners of those properties to make those big capital investments. And it might be things like elevators that need to be replaced, roofs that need to be replaced, windows that aren't as energy efficient as they could be. And we've had a very successful collaboration with those building owners over the years, getting them to invest dollars so that that housing can be preserved for the long term. One of the things about these federal subsidy programs is, unfortunately, if the building cannot meet housing quality standards, can't pass the inspections, then those rent subsidies that are attached to that building will be lost forever. They don't get moved to another building. They simply are lost to the federal government. We do have some good news in the current environment, and that is that the single-family foreclosure rate has declined dramatically, and we're very happy about that. However, communities that were hard hit by foreclosure are still not completely healed, and we are continuing to work particularly with City of St. Paul, City of Minneapolis, and some of the first-ring suburbs that were hardest hit by foreclosures to continue to bring resources to continue to get rid of vacant homes and also to try to bring a greater level of homeownership to those areas. And finally, one of the remaining aftermaths of the foreclosure crisis is that national mortgage markets are still, frankly, very, very restricted, particularly when it comes to low and moderate income families. And I think it's very important, after what we suffered in the foreclosure crisis, that we not go crazy and make the same mistakes that we did in the past. However, things are very, very restrictive in terms of lenders not wanting to take a risk for those borrowers who can afford to buy a house, for example,
but maybe are right at the edges of the qualification box that the regulators are now utilizing. And so they don't want to take a risk that a regulator is going to find that instead of the income ratio being 38%, it's 38.5%, and then it gets thrown out. So it's a cautious attitude, and we have a number of programs that we are working with to try to safely make single-family mortgages to first-time home buyers, but we are doing that in an environment where it's a very, very conservative market nationally. On the next slide, I wanted to review with you sort of what makes up this programmatic budget that you'll hear about in a minute. I mentioned that we do wait until we know what state appropriations will be. And this is sort of a typical source of funds. One of the things that this does not include is the housing infrastructure bonds from last year, because that's a rather large blip on the radar screen, and we thought it would be perhaps more useful to give you a more typical view of the picture. So you see on the left in red is state appropriations for this particular affordable housing plan, which is at 7.1% of our total programmatic budget. I think some people are surprised that state appropriations make up that small portion. One thing I should point out, however, is that those dollars are particularly critical because most of those dollars are dollars that we can use to leverage other dollars that we raise in the capital markets. You'll see that the largest proportion is in green, and those are bond proceeds or other mortgage capital. What that means is that one of the reasons the Housing Finance Agency exists is because we are authorized to issue tax-exempt bonds, bonds that are tax-exempt from federal taxes, and we use those to fund our fairly large home mortgage program and our home improvement program. And those are all amortizing loans that get paid back just like any other mortgage. And in the coming plan, we propose more than $400 million in mortgage originations. And an example of how we use state appropriations in connection with those bond proceeds is that we will often use dollars to make relatively small deferred loans for people to help with their down payment and closing costs. Because one of the things that's been happening over the last couple of years is that closing costs on single-family mortgages have been increasing, and it's one of the barriers to homeownership that we're able to overcome by a combination of state appropriations and some of our deferred agency resources. Federal funds make up about 24%, and almost all of that is in the form of rental assistance for those properties I talked about earlier. And then you see two wedges, and those are agency resources. The purple wedge is our amortizing agency resources. Some of you have been around for a while may have heard us refer to something called Pool 2. Those are resources on our balance sheet that we're allowed to use to make amortizing loans. So they're like a bank owning a portfolio of loans. That's what the purple wedge is for. And we also are able, through our authorizing legislation, that if we are able to generate excess revenues in any given year, we're allowed to move those into what we call Pool 3, which is actually dollars that supplement state appropriations, and we're able to put those out as typically deferred loans. And so those are actually agency resources, think of it as net income, if you will, that we then plow back into programming any year that we have those. We did go several years during the depths of the recession where we did not have any of those dollars available, but I'm very pleased to say that we have returned to a place where there are dollars available for that in the current year, and there were also dollars last year. So the next slide, I think I've already talked about. This is our agency's business plan. It outlines our key programmatic and policy initiatives. It specifies program-by-program funding, and it forecasts expected number of units and households that will be assisted. And for those of you who haven't had a chance to see it, it's probably more detail than you would ever want to know. There's an appendix that gives a detailed description of each of the programs that are included in the line items. It gives a detailed chart, I think it's in Appendix A, where it goes through every single program and also shows all of the funding sources, whether it's appropriated dollars, federal dollars, agency resources, etc. I didn't prepare that for detailed presentation here, but any of you who are interested in walking through that in more detail, I'm happy to do that. I also, on the next slide, did review what our process is. We take this very seriously. We do really reach out and try to get input from the public at a couple of times in the process. We did also, following the publication of the draft plan on the 13th of August, we did also hold a public webinar on August 18th. For which more than 150 people registered. We had a very lively discussion. We have a webinar set up where people are able to ask questions, and it was really very well attended, and there was a lot of healthy dialogue. So in summary, I wanted to talk first about what we hope the outcomes will be. We have several different program categories, and we want to show how we have been able to make progress over the last 3 years in being able to serve more households. Now, that's partly because of the fact that the economy is recovering and there are more people who are able to borrow, but it also does reflect that this legislature has been generous with resources, particularly in the rental production area. So just to give you a sense of the trend, in home ownership and single family refinance, we have gone from about 2,300 households in 2012 to a projected 3,000 households that will assist in 2015. The next item has a decrease, but we think that that's good news because that's our counseling line item. And the reason that the number of households served there is going down is because we have seen a dramatic drop, thankfully, in the number of families that need foreclosure prevention counseling. So really that entire 4,400 drop is because we have fewer families that need foreclosure prevention counseling. I might add that the vast majority of the foreclosure prevention counseling dollars have come from the federal government, and we have been, I think, the fourth largest state in terms of the number of federal dollars that we've been able to attract for foreclosure prevention counseling, even though there are many, many states that have a much larger number of people in foreclosure. We've been very aggressive about seeking out and then deploying those funds effectively through our statewide counseling system. The next line is home improvement loans, and there you see that we're coming up on doubling that level. We saw a pretty low point in our home improvement lending during the recession, and just really in the last 6 months, we are seeing a confidence come back to the marketplace where existing homeowners are really saying, hey, you know, I've got a pretty low interest mortgage here. I'm feeling pretty confident. I've got my job. I'm going to make some improvements to those homes. And we've also, I might add, teamed up with the Commerce Department, which gets some federal Department of Energy dollars to offer a lower interest rate on those loans that are used by homeowners to make energy conservation improvements. So we've got a little teamwork going on there with the Department of Commerce in the home improvement item as well. Rental production, as I mentioned, is where we really have seen the largest increase, and that is due to the fact that the 2012 legislature and the 2014 legislature approved what we call housing infrastructure bonds, which we have used for increasing the number of affordable rental properties that can either be developed or preserved. And finally, agency rental and operating assistance. There we're talking about our housing trust fund, which provides rental assistance for very, very low income households that have experienced or are at risk of homelessness. And we have seen some modest increases in over the years in that rental assistance category as well. Moving on to the dollar amounts, again showing this time showing you a contrast between last year's affordable housing plan and the coming year's affordable housing plan. In home buyer and home refinance, we see a modest increase. Home improvement, a pretty good-sized increase by almost a third. Rental production is our big area where you see the $100 million in bonding authority, housing infrastructure, and GO bonds reflected there. Our rental assistance contract administration is essentially flat, going down a little bit. Those are the federal dollars that flow in for rental assistance. Preventing and ending homelessness, these are the soft dollars, not the bricks and mortar dollars, is about flat. Rental portfolio management is down a little bit. This is essentially emergency repairs, small dollar amounts that can resolve a problem in one of the existing properties in our portfolio. Another place where we've seen a very large increase is in what we call our multiple use resources, and some of you who've been around for a while may recognize this as our Economic Development and Housing Challenge Fund. And we saw both a increase 2 years ago in our appropriated dollars there supporting the Job Growth Initiative, and you see in that line item $5 million out of the $10 million appropriation from 2 years ago that we will be allocating this year, as well as a portion of the housing infrastructure bonds. The other category includes some technical assistance and other minor programs. So we're very pleased that we are seeing a major increase in our programmatic budget this year from $785,000 last year, which we expect to come pretty close to by the end of September, up to $946 million in the coming year. So moving on to some key funding changes. $161 million overall increase, a 21% increase, with more than $130 million increase in rental housing production and preservation. And I already talked about what some of the details of that are. In our home ownership programs, we are proposing $42.5 million more, $24 million more in first mortgages, $10 million in our targeted mortgage program. This is a program where we have just announced three organizations that will be offering this program in the coming year. And this will be for homeowners that have had a hard time accessing the conventional mortgage markets, and it is teamed up with a intensive counseling program. And I know that there are some organizations in the room today that are thankfully participating in that program. We're also increasing our home improvement loan program by about $6 million for next year. On the deferred funding side, $650,000 will go into this home ownership capacity program that's teamed up with the targeted mortgage program. And we've also allocated $2 million in our agency resources to our rehabilitation loan program, which is a very, very low-income program that serves homeowners. I think our average income there is about $8,000 a year. It very heavily serves elderly households, also is a major program in rural Minnesota for people who are living in a home that need really critical repairs. And that's you'll hear from us when the budget comes out this coming year about the really crucial need for dollars in that category as the state's housing stock continues to get older and as we have more seniors who are staying in their homes. One of the uses for that program often is accessibility improvements to single-family homes so that people can stay in their homes and receive care there. I want to really finish by talking about the important role that state appropriations play in the Affordable Housing Plan and, frankly, really set the stage for what you'll hear from us in January. This AHP includes the second year of the 2014-15 biennium, and state appropriated dollars, that little 7% slice of our overall programmatic budget, are really a vital resource that allows us to serve the lowest income Minnesotans. We try to do a really good job of targeting those dollars in a way that they leverage the other dollars that you've seen in our budget. 75% of the rental households that we serve had incomes below $20,000. The median income for the home buyers we served was $48,000, which is quite low compared to the typical home buyer. And 62% of the home buyers we served received down payment assistance. So that down payment assistance is those state appropriated dollars, maybe goes out at about $3,500 to $5,000 in order to help people get into their first home. And down payment assistance is available only to first-time home buyers. And finally, just a summary of how the state appropriations are utilized. Our development or redevelopment is about 28% of the appropriations. The largest share of appropriations go to our efforts to prevent and end homelessness. That's two major programs. One is a rental assistance program. The other is called our Family Homelessness Prevention and Assistance Program, which is actually small grants to families to actually prevent them from becoming homeless. Most frequent use of those funds is for damage deposit and first month's rent on an affordable rental property. Homeownership assistance is a pretty tiny 1.7%. Preservation of existing affordable housing is 23%. And then a small amount for resident and organizational support through our technical assistance program. Over on the right, capital investments, about $36 million in housing infrastructure bonds are projected to be used in this year's affordable housing plan for preservation of affordable housing. About $44 million will be utilized for permanent supportive housing. So those are the capital dollars to build the bricks and mortar, and then oftentimes the appropriated dollars are used in tandem with that for rental assistance. And finally, under preservation, $20 million in general obligation bonds, that makes up the total of $100 million, will be used to preserve publicly owned housing, which is also located throughout the state. We're able to use GO bonds for that rather than housing infrastructure because those are owned by public housing authorities. So with that, just wanted to remind you that our public comment period is closing at the end of this week for the Affordable Housing Plan, and you have the information there on where you can make comments. And I neglected to introduce the person sitting next to me, Katie Topinka, who many of you know. She is our lead legislative liaison, and you'll You'll be seeing a lot of her when she returns to the Capitol, hopefully in early March of next year, after having her first child in November. So we are happy to have Katie here still in our planning phases, and we'll welcome her back early next year. So with that, if there are any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, on our handout on page 3 at the top of the slide, there's a note at the bottom that says 2012 was a low year, and a more typical number for the agency's rental and operating assistance was 2,900. Does that low year for 2012 reflect all five of those categories?
No, just the last category, the agency rental and operating assistance programs.
Okay.
Representative Green?
Sure. And Commissioner, then if do you have the numbers then for the previous and the years in between 2012 and 2015?
As it indicates, there typically are more around 2,900. We just didn't want to give you a misleading impression that it was that big an increase, because it was a little bit of an aberration.
Yeah, Madam Chair, but that's for the rental and operating assistance, but for the rest too. I mean, are the numbers, you know, because of that 3-year span in there where there's nothing else, and you go from 2012. Which was a low year. I was just wondering on the other years how the numbers plug in there. Are they closer to 12 or are they closer to 15?
I would say they're generally a progression upward. We're happy to provide those numbers for you. We have those. One thing that the committee should be aware of is that we do actually provide to the legislature each year a annual assessment report, where we essentially take the affordable housing plan from the previous year and tell you how we did. And there's a lot of detailed statistics in that report. And we would be happy to mail you the report on the 2013 affordable housing plan if you haven't seen that. But that's where we go into all the detail of how we did compared to our goals in the affordable housing plan.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chairman. A couple of questions I have is, as I was taking a look at your information, is number one is when we were on page 3 of looking at the program budget overview, you were showing the amount of money that there was quite an increase from going from 2014 to 2015. One of the questions I have is, historically over the last 10 years, where has that number fluctuated? Has it always been around the 785? Has it been higher than that? Has it been lower than that? In other words, trying to get an idea what historically has happened, because I know things have bounced around a lot.
Yeah, and I don't have those numbers at the tip of my fingers, but I want to say that the first year that I was here, which was 2011, we were more in the $500 million range. Mm-hmm. So we really have seen a major uptick. And a lot of that, quite frankly, is because of the home ownership. We were down probably around $200 million in terms of mortgage originations, and that's now doubled. Just because of the improvement in the economy. And quite frankly, we've taken a pretty aggressive stand on making home mortgages available, because interest rates are so low. Mm-hmm. We think that if ever there's a good opportunity for a first-time home buyer to safely get into a mortgage that they can afford over the long term, it's at this time when the Federal Reserve is keeping interest rates low.
Okay.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you. Yeah, it'd be great to kind of see the historical, if there's a way for me to get the figures
sure,
over the last
absolutely.
10 years. Appreciate it. And the areas where it's going into, I very much appreciate
yep,
that.
Absolutely.
The other question I have kind of fits a little bit into the, we have some areas in the metropolitan area where we have great concentrations of poverty that have occurred. I know that sometimes as we're trying to address issues in those areas, there's a lot of rehabilitation that happens in those areas, and so that's going to take a large number of dollars to protect those units. But outside of that component, where you have to protect those units, what are you folks trying to do to address the concentrations, to encourage, to make sure that we're getting a good mix throughout the metropolitan area and not encouraging, you know, continued investment in areas where we've already got huge concentrations?
Commissioner.
It's a great question, and I would like to give just a tiny bit of context for the members of the committee. One of the largest federal resources that we have available is something called the Low Income Housing Tax Credit. That is allocated by the federal government to each state on a per capita basis, and I think it's $1.75 per capita. So that's it's a formula. That amount comes every year. Minnesota is very unusual in the way that it deals with the tax credits it gets from the federal government, in that state law provides that those tax credits are allocated directly to the city of Minneapolis, the city of St. Paul, Dakota, and Washington counties, and then the balance of the allocation comes to be administered by Minnesota Housing. And so each of those entities, the two cities, the two counties, develop their own allocation plan for those resources, and they lay out their own policies for how those will be allocated. Minnesota Housing allocates those resources for the balance of the state, and it doesn't prohibit us from allocating resources in those four areas, and oftentimes, particularly nonprofit developers, are able to compete effectively in those areas. But it gets a little confusing in terms of who's putting resources into what areas, and particularly true in Minneapolis and St. Paul, where it's not just the state that's bringing resources to those areas, but it's the two cities as well. That said, we try to work very, very closely, particularly with Minneapolis and St. Paul, to make sure that our resources are being used in a complementary way and that we're basically leveraging each other's resources for maximum impact in communities. So, for example, during the foreclosure crisis, the federal government provided a program called the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, which allowed a lot of dollars to go into particularly North Minneapolis, the east side of St. Paul, Frogtown, to take care of vacant houses and to try to sustain a level of homeownership in those communities. And so there are a lot of resources that, for example, have gone into North Minneapolis, which is a racially concentrated area of poverty, but I don't think anyone would have wanted us to not try to stem the tide of the foreclosure crisis in that community. When it comes to allocating new resources, we think it's very important, and it's reflected in our qualified allocation plan, which we publish in February of each year, to state that one of our priorities is the idea of economic integration. And I won't go into a lot of detail what that means, but it essentially has to do in the metropolitan area of where there are essentially jobs that pay sort of low and moderate income wages, and where there is a shortage of affordable housing. And so we very actively allocate those federal tax credits into areas of economic integration. We did a study of the last 5 years of where our resources were placed, and it's actually overlaid on the maps that were developed by the Metropolitan Council, and I will be happy to share that with this, with you, Representative, or with the committee if you'd all like to see that. But it's, you know, it's, I won't say there weren't any dollars that went in, but most of the dollars that went into the metropolitan area, into the inner cities, were for the preservation of existing units, yeah, not for the development of new units.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman, and thank you, Commissioner. One final question I have along the lines, as you're developing and working hard for great diversity, are there any barriers that you folks have identified that we should be aware of and keep in mind as we're addressing legislation in the future that might be preventing you from getting a better mix out in the community in those kind of instances?
Commissioner.
Well, I do know that you'll be hearing from a representative of the Metropolitan Council today, and I would just say that we work very closely with the Metropolitan Council, and, you know, I would say that maybe not so much legislatively, but certainly in your leadership positions of emphasizing the importance that all communities in the metropolitan area really shoulder their fair share of providing affordable housing and that they address that in their local housing plans. We unfortunately do still hear from developers who are interested in developing affordable housing in the suburbs that they get a lot of NIMBY pushback, but not in my backyard. And this is despite the fact that developers have often been in a year or 2 years beforehand working with planning commissions, working with city councils to demonstrate that the housing will be an asset for the communities. Sometimes when it gets to that last planning hearing, the neighbors show up and it often ends up adding to the cost, and sometimes it means the housing doesn't occur at all. So I'd like to imagine that there will be a day in my career when that will no longer be the case, but unfortunately is a reality that we still face.
Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner, I just along that same line, I think it might be important for someone like myself who represents the inner city to indicate that our cities are sometimes in the same position as some of our suburbs. Certain parts of our cities don't necessarily want to have low-income housing their fair share either. So just to be equitable about that. Representative Herta.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have both a question and a comment. The question involves the slide that you had on page 3 regarding expected outcomes, and I noted about a 25% increase in refinance activity. And my question is, do you have any data on those refinances as to what the underlying motivation or reason is? Is it because they're stressed and having to restructure their loans, or is it because of market improvements in interest rates and they're taking advantage of more affordable costs?
Commissioner. Thank you for that question, Representative. Refinance is a relatively new activity that we have only offered for a couple of years, and it's frankly a pretty minor percentage of the activity. Most of that activity is actually first-time homebuyer new purchase activity. But we felt in the wake of the foreclosure crisis that there was a need to provide refinance dollars, and there in relatively limited circumstances. One would be a an older household that wants to downsize, and they really don't, because of the fall in house prices, they really didn't have the equity that historically an older household might have. And so that's one circumstance. The other circumstance, again, where because of falling values, a family might need a larger house because their family is growing, but they just don't have the equity to take with them to be able to refinance in the straight marketplace. So again, a fairly small percentage. Don't have that percentage at my fingertips, but I want to say it's the less than 15% of the total activity is actually refinances. And we try to keep it fairly constrained because we think our most important goal is that first-time homebuyer programs.
And Madam Chair, my comment is directed at the earlier presentation remarks about closing costs and deferment of closing costs, down payment and closing costs. Representative Fisher mentioned what barriers are there legislatively. And I would like to just remind members of the committee that legislatively, one thing we could do to improve the housing market and make access more affordable, Minnesota is one of seven states that collects mortgage registration tax and deed tax. And that's a considerable portion of closing costs. Closing costs transactionally run anywhere from 2 to 3%, typically 2.5% of the transactional cost. Of that closing cost, more than half of it generally is mortgage registration tax and deed tax. And when you find consumers rolling those costs into a 30-year mortgage, that basically triples that cost. And so we, as looking at barriers and how to eliminate some barriers, we really should become one of the 43 states that don't collect this tax. It's regressive, and it's an impediment to home ownership. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Commissioner, you mentioned earlier that we have high vacancy rates in terms of rental properties. Do you see that down the road leading to a softening in rental prices, or at least a decrease in the increase of rental rates as we look ahead?
Mr.
Representative, actually I indicated that vacancy rates are falling, meaning that they're very low. So in Minneapolis, for example, I believe vacancy rates right now are below 3%. So what that has meant is exactly the opposite, that rents are increasing as property owners see the opportunity, because of the low vacancy rates, to increase their rents. Now, as we see some of the new rental properties that are under construction now coming online, will we see much relief in that? I don't really think so. And the reason for that is that home ownership rates are still at historic low points in the state, and we are seeing, particularly in the 18 to 35 year old, which is the typical kind of first time home buyer age cohort, that first time home buyers are delaying the purchase of their first house by anywhere up to 5 years. So they're staying in the rental market and putting a lot of pressure on the rental market, and I think we're going to see a continuing increase in rents, which will mean more pressure on affordability.
And Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, there's a typo on the slide.
Oh, okay.
So on slide 3, it does say high rental vacancy rate. It should say low rental vacancy rate. Sorry about that.
Okay.
Representative Moran.
Good morning, Madam Chair. First, I would like to thank the Commissioner for her presentation today. So I have a couple of questions I would like to, or clarification about what I think I heard. So you, on page 2, the slide address that when you break down the sources of funds that come from the Minnesota Housing, that the federal funds are at a high of 56%, where a lot of those dollars are paid for rental assistance. Right, I think that's what I heard.
I'm sorry, the 56.7% is actually bond proceeds. That's really more of our home ownership program. That's not federal funds.
Those are not federal funds. Okay, we have 23% from federal funds, which a large portion of those federal funds are geared towards the rental assistance programs.
That's correct.
And we also state with the state appropriation at 7.1% that those funds were highly addressing homelessness within the state of Minnesota.
That's correct, Commissioner.
State. Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I guess one of the things that this is diagram is a typical sources of funds, but I was wondering what the state appropriation is going into 2015. What percentage? Because I'm going to assume that it's a little bit higher than 7.1%.
No, we expect it to be about the same.
About the same, even with the increase in...
And Madam Chair, Representative Moran, so this chart is based on our numbers in the 2015 Affordable Housing Plan, and the state appropriated dollars that are in this 2015 plan are the second half of the current biennium. So they're the state fiscal year 2015 funds that you have all already appropriated to the agency. So we haven't factored in any new appropriations, whatever that level may be. We did make some assumptions because we have since our AHP year runs on a different timeline than the state state fiscal year, we did make some assumptions for those couple of months. So from July 1st through the end of the AHP year, we just assumed a base budget going forward for planning purposes.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair.
Representative Moran.
The other question I have was, I'm looking at on page 3, looking at expected outcomes in homeowner education and counseling. And I know that money has been allocated for community organizations to work towards more education around home ownership. And so I just was wondering about your prediction that in 2015, why you believe the need that there would be a less need for foreclosure counseling.
Commissioner?
We have seen the number of homes in foreclosure drop by about half, and we see that continuing to fall. The trends are continuing to fall, and so we just don't see the need for foreclosure prevention counseling that we've seen in the last several years. And again, one of the things that this reflects is that we have been able to attract federal dollars for that foreclosure prevention counseling, and really frankly continue to utilize the majority of the state appropriated counseling dollars for homebuyer counseling. Some is used for foreclosure prevention, but not a lot. So this is not, it's not reflecting that we think there should be a decrease in homebuyer counseling. We just see a natural decrease in the foreclosure prevention.
Thank you. Ms.
Moran?
Yeah.
Commissioner, Representative Moran's question kind of leads me to one that I've been thinking about, which is, I think in several places in the last legislative session, we put language into both the infrastructure bonds and into the your general appropriations that we wanted the agency to try to make an even greater effort than you have in the past to try to deal with the issue of racial equity in terms of homeownership. And maybe Representative Moran might be thinking a little bit about that too, in terms of we want to see more investment in the homeownership counseling there. And so I don't know if that's necessarily that particular fund. I know that you've done some very creative and important things in that arena, and I didn't hear you mention that today. So I'm wondering if you could just talk about that a little bit, the progress that you both have made, and then kind of what you're intending in terms of this whole issue of the big disparity gap we have in terms of home ownership based on race.
I'd be happy to do that. So we are currently operating under our 2014 Affordable Housing Plan, which we adopted a year ago. And in that Affordable Housing Plan, for the first time, we designated $10 million. And if you go back to the pie chart on slide number 3, the purple resources are the amortizing agency resources. That's the kind of the lower right-hand corner. There we go. It's up on the screen now. The purple wedge is amortizing resources. We allocated $10 million out of that resource last year to be able to take mortgages onto our own balance sheet that we were not able to fund with traditional amortizing mortgage resources. Out of the blue triangle, we took $650,000 that we are making available for what we call our enhanced homeownership capacity counseling program. And those dollars, we started working with communities back in January of this year after we had proposed this in the Affordable Housing Plan. And we have now awarded both the $650,000 to, I believe, 7 organizations around the state. And I do have the program manager here, Tal Anderson, who can answer any more detailed questions about that. And then of the $10 million that we made available out of the purple triangle, the amortizing resources, we have awarded those to 3 organizations that will have the ability to originate alternative mortgages from that. Both of those programs, while we cannot be exclusionary, are very heavily focused on populations that have a lower homeownership rate, and so you will see among the groups that have been selected for the counseling dollars experience in many different cultural and ethnic communities, and we will be announcing in more full detail those two allocations about September 15th. We just awarded those contracts in late July, and frankly, the organizations wanted to have the opportunity to get their programs geared up before we made a big publicity push. We wanted to make sure that they're ready to go, that they're ready to start answering the phones, and we are working with them to be ready for those announcements in September. We were pleased enough with the kind of response we got from the community to those resources that we have essentially decided to double the size of the program. So in the 2015 program, you see an additional $10 million for mortgages and an additional $650,000 for the counseling. So that's $20 million for mortgages and I guess it would be $1.3 million for the counseling dollars. So we feel that we really want to see how things work with these organizations. And just to give you an idea, the seven organizations that will be doing the homeownership capacity counseling include Build Wealth, and I know David McGee is here today, CLUES, which serves the Hispanic community, NIDA from the west side of St. Paul, BGWIN, which serves the Native American community. In Greater Minnesota, we have Three Rivers Community Action. We have the Hmong American Partnership and Project for Pride and Living. So those are the seven organizations, and they are right now developing their plans. They know that they have the funds. We've executed contracts with them, and as I say, we will be announcing the program much more publicly in September when they're ready to go. The three organizations that are offering the targeted mortgages, so those seven organizations can channel if they need a special mortgage for those individuals into Build Wealth, Habitat for Humanity Twin Cities, and the SHOP Home Mortgage Program, which is managed by the Greater Metropolitan Housing Corporation, which operates both in Minneapolis and St. Paul and the suburbs. So one of the things I do want to point out is that there's no requirement that people who get the counseling from the program actually need one of the mortgages out of the dollars set aside for special mortgages. If there is a family that, when they get through the counseling, they can actually go to one of our regular mortgage programs or even to a standard marketplace mortgage program, that's great. We don't need to use scarce resources for someone who can, after successful counseling, actually qualify under the normal criteria. So we think that the $10 million will actually be at the small end of the number of mortgages that are generated by this program.
Commissioner has been pointed out to me we're probably running a little behind on our schedule, but you know, I wanted to say it's been very helpful. You've given an excellent presentation. The questions have been good, and I have a few more. I'm just going to sit on them because I want to make sure that we can hear from not only the Metropolitan Council on their plan, but also from our guests who've indicated they want to testify today. Will you be able to hang around and
yes.
hear that? Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For your testimony. I really appreciate it. So next, we want to hear from the Metropolitan Council on their housing plan. Guy Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Maybe it's loaded on this.
Difficulty here, maybe.
This is a new. Yeah. I hate to turn it off.
Many members, I can remind you, you can hand in your per diem slips. We've been a very conservative committee, so we have the ability to make sure that we can pay you for your travel and your time spent here.
Okay. Oh, great. Back to this one. I don't think it turned out. And I. Okay. Let's see if it's new.
So, Mr. Peterson, I believe you have a handout, and maybe if we're having technical difficulty, we could get started with the handout. And
certainly.
Why don't we just go ahead and do that in terms of interest of time here?
But I don't.
I think we all have that. Lou? Yep.
Okay. Oh, we got it. All right, slideshow. All right, great.
Then I just hit up here to advance.
Okay, from beginning.
Oh, my gosh. Good job.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm here to speak to council's role, Metropolitan Council's role in affordable housing, and more specifically, some information about our housing policy plan.
Mr. Peterson, do you want to give your title?
My name is Guy Peterson, and I'm the Community Development Division Director at the Metropolitan Council. Let's see. There we go. Sorry. First of all, let me just, I want to quickly go over the some of the major roles and responsibilities of the Metropolitan Council with regard to affordable housing. First, we have the Operate Metro HRA, which provides rental assistance for low and moderate income folks in the metropolitan area. Actually, we have the largest Section 8 program in the state of Minnesota, and we serve over 6,800 households providing rental assistance, most of which, of course, is federal Section 8 rent assistance. We also implement the Metropolitan Land Planning Act and the affordable housing planning responsibilities and aspects of that legislation. Communities are required to prepare a housing element in the local comprehensive plan, which addresses their share of the region's affordable housing needs, and to guide land sufficient to meet those needs, and to participate in programs and identify those, as well as the official controls and land use activities that they will engage in. Third activity is the implementation of the Livable Communities Act, and that entails negotiation with local governments of affordable and life cycle housing goals, the preparation by these local governments of a housing action plan, and also the distribution of more than $15 million worth of grants each year for development activities, polluted site cleanup, and affordable housing. And then finally, the housing policy plan itself, which is an activity unlike Commissioner Tingerthal talking about a plan that they do on an annual basis. Our housing policy plan is anything but an annual activity. In fact, we are engaging in this right now for the first time in quite a number of years. The council hasn't had a housing policy plan since the end of the 1990s. And even then, the plan was a decade old plan at that time, prepared in 1985. But this council, Metropolitan Council, has wanted to emphasize affordable housing and has directed us to prepare a housing policy plan. So last year, even very early last year, in 2013, we put together a group of individuals, of 26 people that are involved in the plan. Consists of Metropolitan Council members, a couple of them, chaired by Council Member Stephen Chavez, and then also involved a number of folks from local government, from the housing advocacy community, developers, people from the funding community. We have a representative from Minnesota Housing that's on our housing policy plan work group, as well as folks from other organizations. And they have spent the last year, since last summer, working, meeting every month, often meeting more than monthly in subgroups to look at such things as the allocation of affordable housing need in the region, the issue of housing performance scores, which is a way we assess the activities of communities and how well they're doing to advance affordable housing, and then how we might use those affordable housing performance scores in the distribution of other funding, such as we have been doing with the Livable Communities Funds themselves. We've had a number of key discussions and heard from a number of experts over the course of the year, looking at the issues of the equity and concentration of poverty and the housing concerns that, that they generate. We've looked at our own the statutes that govern the council's activities and our policies and processes. We've looked at the issue of barriers to mixed income housing, which is a particular particularly difficult problem. And we've also looked at the issue of demographic shifts and population forecasts. And so we've, the plan, this group of 26 people has worked diligently over the last year, put together this draft plan, which the council has sent out for a public comment. On July 23rd, it was adopted and sent out for public comment. Such since that time, we've been engaging with a number of groups that have asked us to come and speak with them and meet with them and discuss the plan. So we're in the process of doing that. In fact, we'll be beginning this evening a series of nine meetings where we'll be out in one in each of the counties and obviously in Hennepin and Ramsey, a couple of different meetings where we'll be talking with anyone that wants to show up for the meeting. It's kind of like an open house situation workshop to talk about the housing policy plan and also our transportation policy plan. We're going to have a public hearing on our plan on September the 15th. At our Community Development Committee meeting. We'll take public comment through the 26th of September, and then in November we're looking at having the council adopt this policy plan. I want to just spend a little bit of time going over some of the particular aspects, overview of the objectives of the housing policy plan. They are to provide data and other information needed to make policy decisions regionally and locally, provide goals and strategies for regional housing opportunities that align with 5 MSP 2040, which is our recently adopted revised regional development framework plan, to meet our statutory and organizational obligations while following transparent processes, to lead and convene to address the region's toughest housing challenges, and to monitor and evaluate the state of housing in our metropolitan region. Now, the priorities set forth in the plan are in line with Minnesota Housing. The commissioner talked a great deal about the emphasis on preservation, and we have that as one of our priorities also in our policy plan. Preserving the existing is one of our priorities also in our policy plan, preserving the existing housing stock, as well as creating and preserving a mix of housing affordability around our transit investments, particularly our transit station areas and our LRT and BRT system, to expand housing options for people in all life stages and all economic means, to encourage redevelopment and infill development, to reduce barriers to developing mixed income housing, and to promote environmentally sustainable building. Now, obviously there are many things that the Metropolitan Council cannot do. It's not within our purview. We don't have the ability to do those things, but we can lead discussions, and we can convene conversations, and we can try to lead on issues. And some of these on this slide are identified on this slide. To reduce barriers to development of mixed-income housing. Mixed-income housing is a very difficult product to produce. We really live in a world where we have people that finance and invest in market rate, the building of market rate housing, and then another world that focuses on affordable housing. It's very difficult to blend the two, and that conflicts with the general goal and desire of people to have mixed housing, to not have 100% affordable developments, but to have a mixture of market rate and affordable units. But that's very difficult to accomplish in the when you're dealing with the financial realities of how housing investment is made. The issue of exploring inclusionary housing strategies, of assessing the feasibility of strategies to share risk, to reduce or eliminate impediments to fair housing, and to build wealth and expand investment in areas of concentrated poverty. And then finally, obviously we'll want to develop some indicators to monitor the progress and to monitor our success and measure it. So some of the things we'll be looking at and developing as measures will be the issue of housing cost burden, and what achievements, what progress are we making with regard to that. New affordable housing created, obviously just the pure measurement of how many new affordable housing units are we adding in our region versus the affordable housing needs that we've identified. And I can tell you that the housing needs are always far surpass our ability to create new affordable housing opportunities. The balance of low-income households and affordable housing, the share of regional residential development in transit areas, increases in the housing performance score. You know, if we do this measurement each year, we look at a number of different factors and criteria, and are we seeing improvement in all of the local government scores in terms of how well they're doing with regard to affordable housing? New affordable housing units in higher income areas, and the share of the region's population living in areas of concentrated poverty or racially concentrated areas of poverty. Are we changing that, or are we going in the direction that we have been going the last two decades, which is our areas of racially concentrated areas of poverty in the Twin Cities region are actually growing in size. They're expanding. So are we going to be able to contract that by encouraging investments in those areas, as well as providing opportunity for people to live outside of these concentrated areas of poverty and into other locations. And finally, a share of the Section 8 choice housing vouchers that are living in areas of concentrated poverty or racially concentrated areas of poverty. We're going to be doing mobility counseling efforts through our Metro HRA to try and strengthen the ability of folks who come from these concentrated areas of poverty but move to new communities, principally suburban communities, where they it's difficult for them often. These are new places to them. They've lost their they've moved away from their community because they took the Section 8 voucher and they've gone to where they can find a unit. But oftentimes, so they've moved from this concentrated area of poverty, but because of a number of factors, they move back to that area of concentrated poverty. We want to try to work with these folks and see if we can help them get comfortable in their new setting and in their new communities, and provide them with the services and connections that they need so that they'll want to stay in those places. Mm-hmm. So those are just a few of the kinds of indicators that we've identified that we'll be looking at if we through our housing policy plan as we begin to implement it. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions. I do have slides on the Metro HRA, but I know you want to focus on the housing policy plan.
Well, I thank you very much for that presentation. And committee members, if we have a couple of short questions, I think what I'm going to ask committee's ability to do is if we can extend. We have quite a few people who wanted to testify on both of these plans from the community, and so if we can we meet an extra 15 minutes? Are folks willing to hang in there? I think some of the testimony that's been prepared will be very worthwhile. I see shaking of heads. Yes, all right, good. Thank you. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you define for me what the Met Council's definition of affordable housing is?
Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's actually what we're looking at is housing now in two areas of income categories. Focus on housing that's affordable to households at 30% of area median income and at 50% of area median income. And actually, we are also going to identify affordable housing needs for households at 80% of area median income. But currently, in our current policy, we look at housing that's affordable at 60% of area median income as being the target for affordable housing.
Representative Hertas?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I've read through the Thrive 2040 plan, and with respect to area median income, are you talking about that as a region as a whole, or are you going to be looking at a specific community's median income and then deriving affordability and a housing goal for that community based on their specific median income?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Mr. Peterson.
Representative, no, we will be using the region's median income. That's how the data is collected. That's the figures that are used in the low-income housing tax credit program, in the Section 8 program. They're not looked at on a community-by-community basis. They're looked on by a regional figure. And so it's the region's median income figure that we use.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, if that is the case, then I would just like to point out that in communities of high value and high income, it's going to be much more difficult to achieve those goals if you're using the regional income, because you're talking about immersing a quality or a quantity of housing stock onto very high value land and very high value property. That's going to even be more difficult.
Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, that is difficult, and that is part of the challenge of providing affordable housing in all communities, because not all the land values and the challenges with regard to those kinds of costs are not the same in all communities. So yes, that is
the problem. Then therefore, if the if the goal is to create affordable housing, isn't this contraindicated by trying to move in this direction? I mean, shouldn't you be finding areas where land is affordable and the housing stock is affordable and commensurate with giving the greatest opportunity to those who are seeking housing, rather than trying to make this happen in what is clearly trying to jump over a stone wall?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Peterson.
Representative, it's still an issue, though, of where jobs are, where jobs are located, and there are all kinds of, I'll say, lower-paying jobs, jobs that are that pay in the household, low and moderate income household kind of range, all over in suburban communities, that's, you know. Part of our effort is to put people closer to those kinds of employment opportunities and other kinds of opportunities that might exist. So it's an effort to not concentrate it in particular areas where the land values might be more affordable. But it's a process, and it's not an easy go, and it is not always successful, but it is an effort to provide these opportunities in a wide range of areas, and the kind of opportunities that are available throughout you know, throughout the region.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll stop with that because you want to hear other people.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Fisher and then Representative Bly, and then I think we'll go to our audience.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the questions I have for our testifier is, you know, as you're looking at the areas of concentrated poverty and trying to address those, have you also been looking at the underlying support systems that are needed out there? And I'm thinking of terms of transportation. I've represented the White Bear Lake, Montemite, Maplewood area, and one of the things they used to have in the past was the Northeast Suburban Transit System that used to help address those needs. I know that they're having troubles, when I've talked to the folks in the area, of wanting to make a commitment to do more for affordable housing when many of these people in affordable housing need the mass transit that is not currently available in those areas. And was wondering what is being done with the make sure the transit plan is going to match up to make sure that if communities are wanting to do this, there's the support systems to make sure that these are going to be successful.
Peterson.
Madam Chair. Representative, yes. We are working hard to work with our transit function to make sure that there are those kinds of connections available. Obviously, we can't run a bus line to every place where an affordable housing development might be built, but the availability of public transit is a factor that is considered in decisions about the funding of new affordable housing developments. So we are cognizant of the importance of connections for people and try to make that connection, and we are trying to work through our transit agency to so that they realize that, and they do realize that the importance of that also in their decisions about the frequency of, and the location of their bus lines.
Thank you. Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. The two questions that preceded mine actually relate to the question I have. And I represent a district that is just outside the Met Council area, Northfield. And I hear from employers there frequently that the issue for them in hiring workers who could work in the industries that we have there is housing or transit. And we're too far from the Lakeville kind of bus line. And they're often concerned about having affordable housing where folks who could move into the community and work in their industries. And I guess part of my question would be, in your planning, how might Northfield play? I mean, we have a small section that is in the Met Council area in Dakota County, but, you know, we certainly need some help with that issue. And it points out, you know, not only is interspersing the kind of housing, the mixed housing that you mentioned, not only is it kind of a moral question, but it's an economic question too, that people really need to be able to hire folks that need to move into the community, and they can't find affordable housing right now.
Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair. Well, specifically with regard to Northfield, there's not much that we can do because it's not in our area of authority, but obviously it's the whole idea of working to advance affordable housing out in Dakota County. And Dakota County has a very good community development agency. So the connections with regard to Northfield probably need to be something that's worked through the Dakota County CDA and their development of their affordable housing in their area. But I don't know that they're going to be able also to do things that are, you know, that close to Northfield also as they get outside of their urban service area in Dakota County.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I can tell there's lots more questions and discussion, but we're going to go ahead and we've asked members of the public to be here representing different organizations. So thank you, Mr. Peterson. And what I'm going to suggest is maybe the first two speakers, Suwala Phillips from the Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing, and Mr. McGee, why don't you come on down and be a panel? You're such a good team together anyway. Let's have the two of you, and then we'll have the communities of color after that.
And I want to just take a moment to welcome, we have a delegation here, we're honored to have a delegation here who have been visiting the National Conference of State Legislators, a delegation from Somalia. I'd like to introduce the gentleman, maybe you'd just like to stand up, the parliamentarian, members of parliament from Somalia, to stand up. We welcome you here, and you can hear that we're having a discussion on affordable housing, so I know it's something in Somalia you're probably going to be getting around to as the war winds down, right? And you get more and more peaceable community opportunities. So thank you for being here. Ms. Phillips and Mr. McGee.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members, and thank you so much for taking some of your time off this summer to join us. I hope you also get a chance to go over to our wonderful state fair while you're in town, too. I'm Sue Watlow Phillips. I'm the Executive Director of MICA and President and CEO of Integrated Community Solutions, as well as a board member of the National Coalition for the Homeless. MICA's mission is that everyone, without exception, has a safe, decent, accessible, and affordable home, and that includes rental and home ownership, and you're getting a package of information right now, and there's a few handouts in the middle that I'll be going through. Home is where everyone is welcome, where people have not only affordable place to live, but livable incomes, health care, services, transit, environmentally safe, civil rights are respected and protected, and where people have the opportunity to live anywhere in the community. I want to thank you for passing the home bill last year, the Housing Opportunities Made Equitable, as well as the $100 million for bonding to rehab and building affordable housing in the 2014 session and holding this hearing on these two critical plans. I want to thank Commissioner Tingerthal and the staff and leadership in taking the first step in identifying and initiating programs to begin to address the home ownership disparities. I also want to thank the Met Council and their desire to update the housing plan, which really the last really major one was done in 1985. Mike is going to be providing extensive comments on both those plans. If you've not read them, I really encourage you to do so. They're excellently written. They're a good summary of each of the different programs, and they can really, I think, be very helpful as we move into this next legislative session. Today, I want to just focus on a couple of key issues and things that I think the legislature can do in helping make these plans successful. We are now in the fourth decade of growing homelessness in our country. This is the longest period of homelessness ever in the history of the United States. And that we have attempted through different plans to reduce homelessness, and we have for different parts of our people that are experiencing homelessness. But we still are continuing to see growing numbers. We as a state and as a country have not addressed the systemic causes and not have taken the responsibility as individuals and as society to really bring Minnesota home and to bring us home as a nation. As Commissioner Tingerthal talked about, rents are going up. You need to be making $13.50 an hour working full-time to afford a one-bedroom, $18.50 or so an hour working full-time to afford a two-bedroom. This is an issue where we have a lot of lower-income jobs where people cannot afford. So as a society, we need to make a few decisions. One, is gold or money going to rule our decisions, or are we going to follow the golden rule and focus our decision-making on treating other people the way that we would want to be treated in the same situation? As people of faith in MICA, we are commanded to love others as ourselves. And we need to be responsible. We need to get rid of language like those people, or low income, or, you know, other folks. This is our community, this is our state, and we as a people need to be talking about our community. It's diverse, we need rental, we need home ownership, and we need opportunities for all folks. And we need to make sure that people that are being impacted are at the decision tables, that are running the different programs, and that are helping to move us forward in the correct policy. We need to stop discrimination, and we need to enforce our fair housing and civil rights laws. So specific recommendations. In the Minnesota housing plan right now, about 22-23% of the first-time homebuyer dollars, and you have that right in front of you on this green sheet of paper that was in the middle of that little packet that I handed to you, or you were handed. You will see up at the top in the first couple of items there that about 23% of those dollars go to people of color. We'd like to see that increase to be half, so that we have $200,000 going into first-time home buyer program. We appreciate the $10 million that's in the targeted program. We want to see an increase in that so that we can continue to have more and more people that are people of color and Native Americans being able to get into home ownership. We know right now that 73% of the first-time home buyers look like me. You know, and we know in October 13, 2013, the Federal Reserve, in taking a look at what we have in regards to the disparity on the yellow sheet, clearly indicated just to deal with 10% of the disparity for African American and Latinos, we need to increase that by 11,000 units in 2015. Okay, over 11,000 units. Now, we're talking about in the entire plan on the first time home ownership, 4,000 units. So you can see that we have a long ways to go to address disparity. We need to also have money for Fair Housing Center and doing fair housing testing. On the Met Council, in Chapter 473, their attorney was very clear in a hearing last Wednesday in telling the Met Council they don't have the authority to enforce local comprehensive plans. That needs to change. We need to change that and let them enforce those plans so that we have that fair share that was being talked about earlier, that all communities have the opportunity to house everyone in their community. And in the 2015 session, if you take a look at the green sheet, again on the back side, you will see that the Minnesota Revenue puts out the tax expenditure budget each year and tells us how much money we don't collect. And we need to put both budgets on the table this year, the appropriations budget and the tax expenditure budget, and take a look at how we actually are using our dollars in our communities. Right now, we know that 77% of the benefit for the mortgage interest goes to people at incomes of over $100,000 and primarily Caucasian. So we need to begin to continue to address these issues. To conclude, we need to increase resources for the home program, Housing Opportunities Made Equitable, by $100 million. We need to increase capacity funding to $5 million for the home providers. We need to increase funding to enforce fair housing and civil rights law. In addition to reviewing the fiscal note for any bill that comes before this House or the Senate, we also need to have an equity note that really takes a look at our disparities increasing or decreasing because of what we are passing. The Advancing Health Equity Report that came out in February 2014, all the commissioners signed on to it, and we need to hold people accountable to that. And then the final points as far as what we need to be looking at this year is that any bank or financial institution doing business with the state must be required to significantly at least matching the state roles in addressing home ownership for people of color and Native Americans and addressing other fiscal disparities. We can't let our banks do steering or decide, oh, well, this community I'm going to have credit in and this community I'm not. If they're using our dollars and making money off our dollars, then they have to be responsible for how they're doing those things. We believe we should live our faith every day and treat others the way we want to be treated, with opportunities, justice, equity, and mercy. If we do that, then we really will be what we pledge we are, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Phillips.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
And committee members, I'm David McGee, and I'm the Executive Director for Build Wealth Minnesota. As many of you have heard me testify many times last session, I just wanted to thank all of you who have supported the home bill that Governor Dayton signed into law on May 1st, and all of the language around disparities. And we have been aggressively trying to address disparities and open up opportunities for home ownership for all, and all of your support around the Homes for All bill as well. And we're really trying to move and address and advocate for that word all. We'd like to see those disparities close, and we want to thank you for your support thus far. And we really want to thank Minnesota Housing and Commissioner Tinkerthaw and her staff and Tal Anderson and Kim Stewart and the whole team for really stepping up to the plate prior to us even getting the legislation passed. Had made a really good and strong and powerful statement to put a sizable amount of money into a loan product that is targeted to groups that have certain barriers, but tying it also to some long-term education, which is really critical. And I've seen in the new plan that some of the dollars are being reduced in the area of foreclosure prevention. It'd be nice to see that move over into some of the long-term aggressive education that the Enhanced Financial Capacity program is. These are two great programs. We're one of the organizations that will be doing some of the lending, and we will be doing some of the long-term intensive financial education. We continue to commend you for that. There's about 11 organizations that will be presented with this money and given an opportunity that all have a very strong track record in addressing, assisting communities of color. And we are very proud of that. And I know there's a list of them in the handout with Micah. BG Wynn is noted there as well. And they actually will be supporting seven tribes. So we're talking about this is a statewide effort with seven tribes. We've got organizations like Build Wealth Minnesota, Model Cities, Clues. All of the groups of color are being addressed in this initiative. However, as you can see with the disparities, it just to get for African Americans, just to close the disparity gap 10%, it's going to take about 7,300 units of housing. For the Latino community, about 3,900 units of housing. And that's a quite a bit of resources that it's going to take for us to do that. If we were to effectively do this, the state would actually have to attract about $1 billion a year over the next 10 years, each year, in order to bring a parity with the white households in the area of home ownership. And we know it's been a lot of different barriers and a lot of different reasons why this is, and it's going to take a long time, and it's going to take a lot of help, and we're going to need all of your help here. I know that the Minnesota Housing Agency administratively has done a great job in stepping up to the plate in this, but through your leadership and through your assistance in this next session and the sessions to come, we're hoping that we see all of your faces here again next year, as we know this is an election year. And we're hoping that we get that same support. But we also want to help get your support and your leadership, because we're not going to be able to just do it administratively. We've got to be able to do it legislatively. We're going to also need your leadership in convincing and getting corporations and banks to participate and match at least what the state is doing and at least what Minnesota Housing is doing, as Suwatla Phillips has announced, as kind of testified, that the banks are holding a lot of the state's resources. And I think it's a good opportunity for us to encourage them to match the types of programming and the types of things that Minnesota Housing Administration is doing right now. We also need some assistance in convincing the philanthropic community to also engage in matching these efforts. If we're going to need $1 billion, it's going to take money, and it's going to take a lot of resources and a lot of energy, and also the social service community and all the agencies are going to have to roll up their sleeves and really stretch their capacity in order to bring this forward. So we're asking for you to continue to support us in this area. Thank you for giving this hearing today so that we can hear from both Minnesota Housing and Met Council. I know what Minnesota Housing is doing, and just recently hearing what Met Council is doing. And one of the major goals that Met Council had stated is that they're looking to build wealth in concentrated poverty areas, and they're calling these RCAPs. And I am from Build Wealth Minnesota, which is, I made this my life work, and we've been aggressively doing this and linking with another number of other organizations like Model Cities, Aurora St. Anthony, Clues, and a number of organizations, and actually building wealth. So we really want to see your efforts in supporting what we're doing, and we want to make sure that wealth means the same thing. And so our goal is to see that goes through it. And we're hoping that you said we're looking for an opportunity for you to create and convene and create partnerships and meetings for us so that we can bring this this disparity issue to the forefront in the coming days. And so I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak today, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGee. And committee members, I think what I'd like to do is ask us to hold our questions. There's the councils of color who were very much a part of the home bill that we're just talking about. each want to testify, and so if they can come down, and maybe you don't leave, Mr. McGee. I mean, you can leave the table, but okay. Just stay in the room.
All right.
There might be some questions. All right. Go ahead and have a seat back there, and we'll ask each of the consuls of color to come down. I see that Mr. Garcia is right there. You want to start since you're right there? And Anna Marie Hill or Melanie Franks from the Indian Affairs Council. There you are. So you want to go ahead and have a seat at the table, and maybe you can be joined by the Indian Affairs Council. We'll get started with the two of you. Mr. McDonald is here, and also Mr. Tolkar, I believe. Tolkar. Oh, excuse me. Ms. Tolkar. Orsia. Looks like maybe. Go ahead, have a seat at the table.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Clark. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Hector Garcia. I'm the Executive Director of the Chicano Latino Affairs Council. And I would like to add to what was just said by Sue and David and point out that in our community, which represents about 300,000 Latinos throughout the state, about 40% of us are immigrants, including myself. Many of those immigrants come from a very different background than I was privileged to come from, and from the background of your ancestors who came in the early 20th century. And so there's a chasm of differences in education, in socioeconomic systems that are coming together and probably account for a great deal of the disparities that exist in Minnesota today. And Sue mentioned that those disparities also include 40 years of homelessness. And at the same time, in facing this dire situation, I'm very happy to see efforts such as the Council on Homelessness, in which there is an interagency effort to connect the dots and to bring to bear the efforts of all related areas of interest in our social and economic system. There was a mention of economic integration by one of the past presenters, which is pivotal to considering what needs to be done about home ownership, as is being recommended by MICA and other organizations today. And in our particular case, it is highly important to have all of our community have access to home ownership, and that this home ownership be stable, and that they don't get pulled into lending practices that are less than ethical. And so education, in addition to funding, is very, very important. A lot of these immigrants from Latin America have been exploited. They tend to be highly suspicious of any institution, and that is one of our biggest challenges in the Latino Affairs Council, is creating trust and informing the people, making them aware that this democratic system in which we live is by far more trustworthy. And so I think you could help a great deal by supporting this effort in terms of investment, in terms of interconnectedness of related areas, to bring about not only home ownership, but less mobility in our communities that will reflect also in better employment, better performance of our students, and health and safety, all of which are vital to Minnesota. And so I applaud the efforts of this committee and the home team, and hopefully we will continue working together to make this possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Garcia. Mr. McDonald, I see you're there, if you'd like to.
Yes.
The next.
Madam Chair, thank you for inviting the Council on Black Minnesotans here to speak to the Housing Finance and Met Council's plans. Madam Chair, before I make my comments, the Council would like to thank you for your lifetime dedication to ensuring that all Minnesotans have clean, safe, and affordable housing. Your work and your implied belief that housing should be a right for all Americans resonate with us, and we really appreciate your dedication. Yeah. Madam Chair, members of this esteemed committee, the Council also want to thank you, the Governor, and the Legislature for the great commitment made last year during the session, the money appropriated, the policy recommendations to support ending and preventing homelessness, the increased production of affordable housing, coupled with the leadership of the Housing Finance Agency to allocate resources to set the stage to eradicate disparities in home ownership, is appreciated by our community and those challenged by the ever-changing housing market. Committee members, the Council believe we eradicate housing disparities when we make housing a right and fully fund that right, so that all Minnesotans and Americans are housed. We believe America and Minnesotans have the genius to develop the plans and deploy the funding to ensure that we're all housed. With that backdrop, I would like to make my comments regarding the plan. First, Madam Chair, and the Metro Council and the Housing Finance Department have done an excellent job with the development of these housing plans. The Council appreciate both agencies, their work groups, for seeking the input from the Council and our community. We especially like to thank the Housing Policy Work Group from the Metropolitan Council, led by Commissioner Haig, co-chaired by Stephen Chavez and Beverly Hawkins. Also, Commissioner Tingerhall and Assistant Commissioner Orr and the staff at MFHA. Madam Chair, the Council is in the final phase of our statewide focus group and survey research of concerns in the Minnesotans' African heritage community. Preliminarily, the top three concerns emerging thus far are housing, jobs and economic development, and education. Undergirding these concerns is the issue of equal access and opportunity. So I make my comments and recommendation looking at how we can encapsulate those three concerns around a housing plan. As we continue to sort through this information from the community, we feel safe to make several preliminary recommendations related to the plans. We also have some secondary recommendations that should be considered as we move into the legislative session. Our preliminary recommendations are: we support the Met Council request to use this plan as the facilitated housing operation and development approach with cities throughout the metro region. We support MFHA's plan and approach to address the financing, ending home ownership disparities, the production of more clean, safe, affordable rental housing, and to carry out their roles in the state's collaboration to end and prevent homelessness. We respectfully ask that the legislature and the governor fully fund the requested appropriation from both of these entities. Madam Chair and members of this committee, because the Council is developing a clear picture of our community concerns, which are coming forth after great work put into these excellent plans, we respectfully request the following secondary recommendations be considered. We would like to see the Housing Finance Department, the Met Council, work with management and budget to bring forth legislative recommendations that help the state use its considerable influence with financial institutions seeking to provide services to the state and serve as the depository of state revenues to submit plans that outline how they will provide financial and other support for the implementation of these housing plans if chosen to provide services to the state of Minnesota. Two, we require, we'd like to see MFHA and the Met Council augment their plans to provide detailed implementation of the Housing and Urban Development Section 3 employment and training requirements on all aspects of the plan approach. This is a targeted training and employment initiative for low-income persons. And we believe that the investment of any capital by the state should be targeted and some collaborative effort around employment opportunities within our community, which you all know is challenged in that regard as well. In addition, Housing Finance and the Met Council to augment their plans to provide details as to how they will achieve improved minority and women contractor participation in all aspects of their plans. Again, we're attempting to tie the economic development opportunities that are needed in our community to the investment in the production and the delivery of housing opportunities. In addition, Madam Chair, we would like to see MFHA expand the capacity of the minority homeownership counseling entities so that they can assist outstate minority residents with achieving homeownership. As you all probably know, population centers like Mankato, Rochester, St. Cloud, and Duluth are expanding in terms of its minority population representation, and we would like to see some of the same types of services provided in those communities as well. Finally, Madam Chair, we would like to see Housing Finance explore how the Met Council housing plan can be employed in outstate regions of the state. And then one issue that continues to plague our community, which has an home ownership rate of roughly about 25%, 75% are living in a very transit state with rental housing. We are confronted with this ever challenging unlawful detainer law. And it is making the situation in our community horrible. And we would like the legislature to visit that this session. We believe that there need to be some reforms there, particularly how long the unlawful detainer lingers with a person after it's been assigned. That is moving a lot of our families into homelessness, and that's across the state. So we would hope that some discussions would happen around reforms in that regard. Madam Chair, without these additions, we will still have great plans, and we will make progress, but the plans will not have the greatest possible impact with addressing disparities in housing and employment within Minnesotans of African heritage community. Thank you for allowing me to make my comments on the great work done by these agencies, and we stand with them as they move into the legislative session seeking a full complement of funding to deploy those plans. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. McDowell. We're getting good assignments here, members. Ms. Herr, I think you're at the table, and then Ms. Hill, do you want to join?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. It's good to see all of you again. I've been before this committee before, so it's always a pleasant experience to see all of your faces. My name is Sia Herr, and again, I am the Executive Director at the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. It's an honor to be here today to speak specifically to the MHFA 2015 housing plan. As the representative from the MAC Council has already shared earlier, there's an opening period for public comments. Our council has submitted a written response to the MAC Council's plan. Today, I'm just going to speak specifically to the MHFA 2015 housing plan. The Asian population here in the state and in the rest of the country is the fastest growing ethnic group. And as I have said before, the Asian population community is extremely diverse. As it relates to the topic that brought us all of us here today, the aggregate data on home ownership and income does not begin to capture the existing reality of the disparities that are being experienced by the many Asian Pacific Islander communities here in the state of Minnesota, specifically the Southeast Asian communities. And then I want to even add to that specifically the newest refugee communities within our community. Our council, as we are looking at the trends that the communities are experiencing, we're especially concerned about the increasing cost of rent in the Twin Cities region, making rent an impossible option or a burden for low-income Asian American families. Many of our families lack monthly gross incomes that are three times of the rent as required by private landlords. And many of our new refugee and immigrant families and individuals lack rental and credit history required in the traditional housing market. Therefore, our families are more likely to encounter hazardous living situations for cheaper rent or forego renting by boarding with relatives who are either renting or homeowners. We are also especially concerned about the lack of affordable rental housing for large families in the metro area. The average household size for Asian Americans is 3.5, which is larger than the average family size for other racial groups, and this often results in what we know in the community as overcrowded housing. So when we talk about homelessness, as it relates to the Asian American community, it's very rare to see an Asian American who's sitting on the corner of the street because he or she is homeless. But it is often, almost always the case, that homeless individuals or families will ask a relative if they can live together for a certain period of time, and so overcrowding is a result of that. Again, it's not rare to see a single Asian mother with four children living in a one-bedroom apartment or four Asian males sharing a one-bedroom apartment. Additionally, we are concerned about the low numbers of Asian families accessing traditional and supportive housing, along with experiencing long waiting periods for public housing due to lack of housing options to accommodate our larger family sizes. Furthermore, many of our Southeast Asian refugee families fail to qualify as chronically homeless and or are experiencing repeated episodes of homelessness because they tend to rely, again, on extended families. And oftentimes what we see is that they'll move from one family to another without ever encountering the homeless shelter system. So there are families and individuals in our communities who are truly in need of safe and stable housing and are encountering barriers such as language, transportation, underemployment, inability to access resources, stigma, and shame. I want to emphasize the stigma and the shame, because the Asian American community, if there is one thing you should know about us, is that we're very big on saving face. We're not going to become homeless, because oftentimes that doesn't just say something about we as individuals. It says something about our family, our extended clan systems, our entire racial or ethnic group. So therefore, our preliminary recommendations as they relate to the MHFA 2015 housing plan are, one, we recommend that the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency allow consumers of the rental subsidy programs the choice to live in the community and in the neighborhoods of their choices. This is especially important to the Asian American community because as much as we don't like to see the concentration of poverty, there is this thing called the clan system or the cultural worldview, which is that we all succeed as one or we all fail as one. And so people tend to want to congregate together. Our second recommendation is MHFA increase the funding provided through the Department of Education for highly mobile children and specifically target shelters and schools serving specific communities of color, especially emerging communities. Our third recommendation is for MHFA to increase the available funding for short-term rental assistance programs to help families achieve financial stability in order to maintain stable housing. Next recommendation is for MHFA to increase funding for programs targeting large family sizes and especially multifamily homes so that they remain affordable in the metro area. Our next recommendation is to ensure that the communities of color and especially the Asian Pacific communities are aware of the homeownership, education, counseling, and other resources, and especially programs such as the Enhanced Homeownership Capacity Initiative and the Targeted Mortgage Opportunity Programs. Here at the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, we like to say that it doesn't matter how great the state is and how many programs and how many resources are available. If our community doesn't know about them, they don't matter all that much. Now, I say that with as someone speaking from the perspective of the Asian American community, I'm not disqualifying the availability of these resources. And then we also recommend that MHFA direct the counties receiving the Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program funds to ensure that Asian American families have access to the program without having to go through the traditional homeless shelter. Our last recommendation is that MHFA increase the percentage of households of color, especially households coming from emerging communities, accessing programs such as the low-income housing tax credits and the monthly payment loans. Lastly, our council thanks the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency for drafting and Met Council for drafting plans that seek to ensure sustainable and affordable homes for all. We stand committed to continue collaborating with MHFA and any other governmental agencies to ensure that all Minnesotans have access to affordable homes and that they really, at the end of the day, have access to lives of dignity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Herr. And our final word from our First Nation.
Thank you. So. Thank you, Representative Clark, members of committee. My name is Anna Marie Hill, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. And the Indian Affairs Council was established in 1963, and it is one of the oldest and largest councils of its kind. And our mission is to protect the sovereignty of the 11 Minnesota tribes and ensure the well-being of American Indian citizens throughout the state of Minnesota. I want to state, first of all, that Indian Affairs Council and the members of our tribes and our communities have enjoyed a long relationship with Minnesota Housing Finance in working cooperatively to address the needs of the American Indian citizens throughout the state of Minnesota and to address the affordable housing need. Minnesota Housing has long provided a housing liaison who currently is Rick Smith. And Rick Smith has been the liaison to the American Indian communities for as long as I can remember. And I have been doing this work or work of this kind for approximately 20 years. And so we've been working hard, and we've been addressing the needs that exist within our communities. And I also have to say that the needs have stayed relatively the same for about 20 years. So I continue to hear things and continue to receive updates, wonderful updates from Rick Smith, from Housing Liaison, Minnesota Housing, and they are a member of our board. And the board meets quarterly. So we do hear directly from Minnesota Housing on a quarterly basis on the needs of the affordable housing and the situation with American Indian communities. And again, I just have to address, I just have to state this very clearly, the needs of our people have not really changed. We continue to have some of the highest disparities within our communities. And of course, there are various historical reasons for this. And we have some of the highest rates of disparity in all other areas in the state of Minnesota, and education, healthcare, and it runs the whole gamut. And there are a variety of reasons for this, but affordable housing is one of the biggest issues. Minnesota Housing has always run very key programs within their housing finance, and approximately the figure is about $5 to $6 million. Dollars go to American Indian tribes on a yearly basis, and the awards are given in October to the tribes and to various communities to work on affordable housing and housing projects throughout the state. And I do know that those awards will be made soon. And the demand for housing remains as great as it ever has. Long waiting lists exist. Individuals frequently within the American Indian community, one or more families live within the households. The need for affordable housing on the 11 tribes, not all of them exist, but the tribes that have some of the greatest economic needs, such as Red Lake, White Earth, the northern tribes in Minnesota, they have long waiting lists of individuals, and housing just isn't available. So, as always exists, many things are being done by Minnesota Housing on the federal level, on the state level, to provide housing. And one of the things that tribal leaders and members who and people who work on housing and the need want to reiterate and state at all times is never to cut and never to create bigger barriers or greater barriers that already exist for people to live and afford a good home and have stable places for their children. There are so many efforts that are being made within the American Indian community and from the leaders who work very diligently to provide this housing, and we never seem to quite catch up. And perhaps we look forward to a day that we will. Indian Affairs Council has provided an opportunity for individuals to come to the council as a forum to be heard by tribal leaders on some of the great initiatives that are happening in the state of Minnesota. And one of those opportunities presented itself last year with Sue Phillips from MICA, who came to the Indian Affairs Council to receive the support for the initiatives that she was doing and many individuals were doing to increase the opportunity for people to live in affordable and safe and secure homes. And she did receive this support by testifying, but again, it was stated to Sue that as long as the home opportunities are not cut in other areas, it's very important that we don't look at something happening as an opportunity to also cut back in other areas. So with this, again, I would like to state good news that, you know, we are increasing. There are so many factors that come into play with this, such as unemployment remains so high. The need for good jobs remains high. The need for jobs that provide an income where you can afford to work and have your kids in daycare. That is a very, very real and tragic situation. Also, being able to access the opportunities that are there. Sia mentioned the shame that exists. I don't think we very often talk about that. Individuals who receive any kind of subsidies or any kind of assistance really experience a great deal of shame in accessing those available resources, even though that they are there. But we continue to advocate that the state continue to seek consultation with the tribes, the state agencies continue to talk to the tribes, and with the governor's new executive order, this is definitely a reality. We're aware that Commissioner is going to each individual tribe to talk about the housing needs coming up here very shortly and to put together a concrete plan, and we appreciate any and all efforts that continue to go forward.
Excuse me. Thank you very much. Thank you, all the testifiers and members. Thank you for your patience in waiting. And I think this just tells me we need to have more opportunities for discussion. There were so much to be heard from the agencies and so much to be heard from the community. So we're going to have to adjourn. But I want to say thank you to everybody who did make the effort to come. An incredible testimony that you offered. We were taking some notes of. We got some assignments for next legislative session from you all. Really do appreciate that. So members, unless there's anything urgent else, I would say the meeting is adjourned. Thank you so much.